Welcome back to The Calling. I'm Andrew Boyer, and I'm here with Merrick Zabriskie. And we're delighted today to have Russell Reynolds with us here in the studio. Russell Reynolds, if you don't know, is the name of one of the four biggest recruiting firms in the world with revenues over $1 billion a year, but it's also a person. And so welcome, Russell. And maybe you can start by telling us how you got started with the business you founded.
The way the firm got started was when I graduated from Yale in 1954, I was hired by J.P. Morgan and Company as a banker. And I worked there a few months, and then I did the Air Force. When I left the Air Force, I went back to Morgan. I worked there 8 years. So I had some awfully good relationships with blue chip companies. And I got frustrated at Morgan. I thought they were too conservative, and everything took forever, and I want to get things done. So I spoke to one of my friends from Brazil, the senior society I was in, who had joined a small search firm on Madison Avenue. And he introduced me to some of their clients as a candidate. And I kept thinking, I introduce you to him and I get a big fee. And there was no government regulation as there is in banking. That appealed to me. So I ended up putting my hand up, joined that firm, worked there almost 3 years, became a big producer, wanted to hire bright young people to help me. The boss couldn't see it, so I left and started my own firm. And that's how it started.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like to birth something that was novel? I mean, there were, you know, I guess a couple of firms, but you birthed something that just took off. And so what were those first years like? Was it stressful? Did you feel like, will it make it? Every time you got a great search, good. And then when you didn't have a search, maybe this is going to be the last? How was it?
So I thought I was going to be so successful, that I would need a partner. So I ended up getting Lee Goetz, and I gave him a third of the stock. And I wanted to be able to take vacations and live a normal life. So I persuaded Lee to join me, who'd been a vice president, Manufacturers Hanover Bank. And when I offered Lee the opportunity, he said, well, I'd love to do it. And my wife is all for it. But my wife's father thinks I'm out of my mind. So I flew up to Edgartown and spent an hour or two with George Hinman on his porch explaining the whole thing. And when I got back to Greenwich, Lee said, now you've really screwed it up. George wants to invest in it. So and I did. So I just had a unlimited optimism. I was not afraid of anything. I felt good.
So, an executive recruiting back then, like, it didn't, you said a couple of times, it didn't feel like it had a very, like, shiny reputation.
Terrible. You were called pirates, or you steal people out of companies and
headhunters.
Yeah. And it did not have a great it didn't have a really bad reputation. It just wasn't considered a legitimate business.
Russ, were there times where you really got it wrong, where you picked someone and said, this person's going to be dynamite, and it just blew up? And if so, what did you learn from that?
Well, nobody's perfect, starting with me. I've made a number of mistakes in hiring people. And one person in recent years I hired because she was a very devout Christian, and I assumed she knew what she was doing, and she disappointed me. But the batting average has been very good. And everybody is different.
Do you have a deep sense of intuition? You know, when you meet someone, do you just get this sense, or do you, are you
I
more?
I do. Yeah. I size people up in about 2 minutes. I make an initial impression. They're boring, they're stupid, they're geniuses, they're exciting, or whatever. And then I say to myself, now I will see if I'm right.
You describe yourself as an otter, I believe. And mm-hmm. surely you play some sharks in charge of things. And tell us, what does it mean to be an otter? And you can't be always selecting someone like yourself. So where do you know, okay, I'm an otter, but this position that we're filling calls for a shark or a turtle?
Well, I've never filled a position that I thought called for a shark. And if it did, I wouldn't take the assignment. An otter is a happy animal and lies in the sun on his back and plays with the ball. And that's the way I see myself. Not a simpleton, but keep it simple, stupid. Don't engulf yourself with trivia that makes your life too complicated. And I'll never forget, I was talking to David Rockefeller one time, and I said, when are you the happiest? And he said, when I'm with my wife and children having a picnic in Maine. And that's sort of me.
You do spend your summers in Maine, don't you?
We do.
Yeah. So what outside of the work world, I know you're very involved, you have been over the years with Yale, you're a great sailor, great rackets player. What are some of the things that have brought breadth into your life, and what would you coach other people about finding balance in the midst of trying to find success?
Well, I've always been interested in good management, and that starts with the federal government. So I became interested in politics, and I spent a lot of time with Reagan and later with Bush 41 and some with Bush 42 and also with Romney and also in state politics. So I've done a lot of volunteer work with in the political world, and I was asked by one of your leading parishioners 40 years ago to get much more involved in politics, and I thought about it, and I said, uh-uh. And I've been quite involved in extra, not-for-profits like the Historical Society and Mystic Seaport Museum and the Outward Bound School and Hotchkiss School and Gordon College and Christ Church. I was very active as a vestry member and on the, particularly on the real estate committee. And I think that, frankly, getting out and doing things that are worthwhile is very good marketing for your business.
One of the things I noticed is you actually started your book talking about how you weren't pushed out, but that you actually had to essentially retire from the company that had your name on it, which must have been. And then, of course, you turned around a year later and started another recruiting firm. Would you have wanted to kind of keep going, growing that as much as you could, or were you sort of, would you have not changed any of the paths that you took?
Well, without getting too deep, I do believe that God talks to me. And when I turned 60, I began to think that I was getting very tired of what I was doing. I was traveling all over Asia, all over Europe, and all over the U.S., and I was becoming a minor celebrity, and I was, quote, on display a lot. Oh, here he comes. And I have the world's best wife. I have three wonderful children and 11 grandchildren. And now we have two great-grandchildren. And I just felt, number one, I don't think wealth is a worthy objective. I think security is, but not wealth. And when I was in my early 60s, I thought I could probably eat without doing anything. And so I developed a deep desire to leave the firm. And I think a few younger people sensed that, or, and I was pretty high profile, and I certainly didn't, I was not bashful about spending money. I think that produced some natural envy. And when I did leave the firm, I had a huge disappointment because a couple of people that I thought I knew well, I learned that I didn't know as well as I thought. And I'm a big believer, if you have a problem with somebody, you ought to look them in the eye and tell them and talk it over. And I find you almost always become better friends. And that didn't happen. So, and there was a clique that wanted to get rid of me. So when I realized that a couple of people were not what I really thought they were, I decided to let the clique deal with them, and I gracefully withdrew. And I was paid fairly well at the time, but it's, looking back on it, it's modest. And but in the meantime, I've had other great experiences, and I'm not at all sorry.
So let me ask you, Evan Osnos's book, American Fury, the creating of, I think, like, American Anger or something. He grew up in Greenwich and is a writer for The New Yorker, took his first job in West Virginia, and then went to Chicago, then was overseas. Anyway, he chronicles the changes in Greenwich, such as when the former CEO of GE lived here, he was making 32 times what the average employee made. And Osnos said executive compensation for CEOs now is something like 278 times the average employee. In some firms, it's much greater. Are you worried that that's ballooned out and become kind of excessive at this point?
In those cases, yes. But I think the average CEO is much more sensible. And I'll never forget the years ago when Robert Gozetta, a CEO of Coca-Cola, paid himself a third $100 million stock grant. I just thought it was disgusting. And I think that the court of public opinion is very strong, and that good people sense that, and they know how far to push it. And boards, I mean, boards, any board that allows their CEO to make that much money should be replaced. And ultimately, something happens. So I'm not all upset about it. I think the individuals who are overindulging need to take a breath, deep breath.
So I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said that you can find interesting things about people when you take them out sailing. When you took, you know, prospective people that you were trying to place in a position to play squash or tennis or out on a sailboat, what are some of the kinds of things you found that were revealing that helped you think, boy, this is or is not the right person?
Well, one time I was asked to find the CEO of British Steel in London, and Margaret Thatcher thought the place was a disaster and it's being run by the, into the ground by the unions. So they gave us the assignment to find the CEO of British Steel, which is a big deal. So we looked around and we found a man named Ian McGregor, who was from Greenwich. And he was a crusty Scot. And we started digging around, checking him out and everything. And one thing we learned was that he walked to work in London. And it took him about an hour each way. And he did it to save money. And that really impressed me.
Thrifty Scot, if ever there were one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the CEOs and directors in the corporate world are really good people. And it's the bad apples that get the headlines.
Was there one search that stands out and said that this was maybe the most difficult search we ever undertook?
One day, I got a phone call from a fellow named Jack Nash, who was the number two operating partner of Oppenheimer and Company, which was a money machine, and one of my biggest clients. And he said, Russell, telephone, Russell, do you know what a risk arbitrage trader is, yes or no? No. Well, I'll tell you what one is, God damn it. And he went into the spiel, and I was frantically trying to write this down. And we're talking about somebody who makes many millions of dollars. And he says, find me one, for God's sakes. Slam! And I go, what in the world am I supposed to do? So I very quickly found out what a risk arbitrage trader was and did. And within a couple of weeks, found one, introduced one person. They hired the guy, and he did, he was fantastic.
You know, the name of our program is The Calling. So we want to close out and just ask you, what's it been for you to have a calling in life? And has your faith been instrumental in discerning that and living it?
Well, I was born and lived in a house under the steeple of the Second Congregational Church, which had a very loud bell that rang all night long. And I screamed and yelled and complained to my parents. And they said, and I was still in a crib, and they said, that is God talking to you. Be grateful. And I've always felt that way. So I don't, you know, do I have a calling? I don't know what it is. But I am very committed to my colleagues, and especially to my family.
Russ Reynolds, you have spent a lifetime being positive, being grateful, and being of service. And we thank you for joining us today. It's been an honor to talk to you. It's a joy to be a friend and to know you. And it was so much fun to watch Debbie and you be the first on the dance floor last night in your tux. God bless you. We've loved having you here.
Thank you, Merrick. Thanks very much. Andrew.